Thanks for joining us on the Port City Church podcast. More information about Port City Church is available at portcitychurch.org.
Good morning. It's great to, it's really good to be here with people in the room. I know if you were tuned in earlier, thank you so much. If you tuned in earlier, you know that we're beginning our regathering sort of strategy. We have staff and families in the room, and just as we have said from the very beginning, we are going to be intentional and we're going to be incremental in the way that we regather, because it's important to both who we are, how we do things, but it's also important who we are as a church. And really what I want to talk about today is this is not just about regathering, but all the things that are happening in our world and our lives are extremely important for who we are as a church. I believe the opportunity that we have as a church, and part of what I'm trying to train my brain, I'm a big believer in language. I try to use phrases very intentionally. And most all of us talk about a way forward. Most all of us talk about getting somewhere other than where we are. And what happens to me, I may be the only one, but what happens to me in those moments is I start calculating how to get out from where I am, to get onto something else or somewhere else. When this issue isn't as big of an issue, or this thing isn't as big of a thing, and I can tend to something else. And I think that's dangerous thinking, because it misses so much of the potency that's available to us in these moments, the acute nature of what we are experiencing together, regardless of what you believe about what you believe. All of this matters to us in ways that I don't know that I can fully appreciate. And so I'm working really hard to try to do that. So I'm not using this idea of a way forward. This is not a way forward, but rather this is a way together. I think the opportunity for us is to learn and to understand a way together, and that's very different. So I want to begin by asking you a couple questions. Number one is, what is it you care about? What is it that you care about? It's Father's Day, right? So my kids care about me. I'm sure they're like, they're at home watching. They're like, oh, we care about Dad. You know, happy Father's Day. What do you care about? Do you care about sports? Do you care about Duke or Carolina? Do you care? We've forgotten if that's even a thing now, probably. Do you care about politics? Do you care about issues? Do you care about money? Do you care about cars? What do you care about? Most of us, we assume that caring comes naturally, and it does in a lot of ways. But if we're not really careful, we end up caring about things that aren't really that important to care about. And maybe more importantly, we end up not caring about things that are actually really, really, really important to care about. And we begin to wonder, is there a way in which we can learn to care about things that we don't naturally care about? And the answer is yes. I have daughters. I grew up with all boys. We had, Legos and sports stuff. And then I have girls, and I have like my size Barbies and all kinds of other crazy stuff in my house. And my daughter was a ballerina. She loved ballet. Now, to be honest, I don't care much about ballet, right? It just wasn't a thing for me. But somehow, when my daughter began to take ballet, all of a sudden, I began to care about ballet. The reason is not because I cared about ballet. That's a part of it. But I can't go every time I pick up from ballet, go, oh, did you see the latest score of the game? Did you see what happened in this sport or that sport? Now I've got to become interested in what she's interested in, because it's an act of love. To actually care about what's important to someone else is an act of love, and we lose sight of this. We keep thinking about, well, that's not how I feel, that's inauthentic. And we assume that we can't learn to care about things that we don't naturally care about. And that's what I think is so important about what we have to do going forward. One of my greatest parenting moments was, I have two, all of you here know, but if you're watching new, I have two children that are, we have a 4-year-old, almost 25. She's been married for a couple years, and then I have a 19-year-old in college. So we're on the backside of the parenting spectrum. It's really, really fun now. So for all of you who are like struggling with like all the little ones, it gets so much fun. One of the hardest things about parenting was teaching your kids to drive, because it was maddening and it was terrifying. So what we decided to do with our firstborn is we came up with a driving contract. And it was this in my head, this was a genius idea. So it was like legally written, and it had all the things in there that you should do and shouldn't do. It was things like, and it was almost like a threat, like, driving is a privilege, not a right. this car belongs to me, not to you, is all these things that we were able to put into the language. We were able to say things like, we banned her from listening to the radio for, I think, 6 weeks. No radio in the car for six. This is before, like, USB cords and iPhones and all that stuff. So no radio in the car. And you got to be home. And here's if your friends say that. It's just this list of rules. I thought it was fantastic. So I'm like, we're going to have our first adult conversation, responsibility conversation, safety conversation. And I go in there, I said, Madison, we're going to be working on getting you a car and driving and learning. And here's the contract we're going to ask you to sign. And she looks at this. And she looks at me. And she starts to cry. But Madison's a lot like me. She doesn't really tear up, but boy, she will come at you hard. And so it was probably the biggest fight we ever had. And so I'm like, yo, we got to back into this because I'm not really sure what happened. Like, this is negotiable and all this stuff. I don't know what you're freaking out about. And we go back and forth and back and forth. And I'm trying to understand. Don't you understand this is responsibility? Don't you understand this is about your safety? You know what she said? She said, Dad, don't you trust me? Here's the thing. We both cared deeply. We both cared about safety. We both cared about responsibility. I cared that she was safe, and she cared that she was trusted. And all of a sudden, that created an impasse that allowed us to spend a lot of time arguing about the rules and what was right in that contract instead of fighting for the relationship. I think what happens for a lot of people in our culture, maybe it's in your families, it's certainly going to happen more and more and more increasingly with all the stuff that's coming unfolding before us politically. It's going to happen. You're going to have friends and family members, and you're going to be pulled apart if you spend more time fighting about and arguing about the facts and what's happening than you do fighting for the relationships that matters. At some point in time, as followers of Jesus, we got to take his word seriously, his way seriously, and decide that the relationships are more important, to learn what it means to really love others the way we love ourselves, out of this idea that we have loved God with all of our heart, soul, mind, and strength. We have to learn how to do that. This is not some kind of, oh, let's just talk about this in a nice, fluffy way. These are some of the most difficult days that we're going to face, relationally, anxiety-wise, pressure-wise. And for those who have means and access, you're going to be able to get on with things in a way that other people aren't. And the problem is with that mindset is it's going to go back to the way things were. And I just don't think that's acceptable anymore. What I wrote here is that we ended up arguing about the contract instead of fighting for the relationship. When I understood her story, it changed what I required of her. When I understood that she was more concerned about the trust that she was being given or not given, it changed what I required of her. And when she understood my story, it changed the way she responded. When she understood that I was terrified to put her in a car and to send her out with crazy people who cannot drive, and we all know that's true. Interestingly enough, most people think they can drive, and we all know that they can't. But when she understood my story, it changed the way she responded. Y'all, this is what we have to have. When you understand someone's story, it changes both what you require of them and it changes the way you respond to them. Narrative is more important or more powerful than facts. Our facts, the facts that you use, the facts that I use are always interpreted through the context of our story. And our understanding of the facts will almost always drive us to defend our position. Think about this. The deeper and the more you understand, the more tightly laced your arguments are, the more apt you are to defend them, and then the more apt you are to offend other people with them. But if you enter someone's story, it will help you understand. You know, this is what I want us to do. I think this is what actually Jesus invited us to do, and I want to show you this. Make no mistake about it, there are two ways. There are two ways forward. It is not left and right. Most people think that is two different ways. That is the same way. Those are the same two sides of the same coin. Jesus has invited us into a fundamentally different way to live. It's fundamentally different, and we are not going to get it quick, and we are not going to get it just because we have our little belief boxes all checked. It's going to be when we learn how to walk in the way of Jesus over time. This is exactly what he's invited us into. I've been using this phrase for about three or four years now, this idea, and it started with just thinking about the kingdom. We're going to be in Matthew chapter 13 if you have your Bibles, and you can flip there. It's a famous parable that Jesus told. But I've been living in this for a while, mainly because we've been having conversations about the kingdom of God. I've been saying for years, the kingdom is not a place, it's a way. The kingdom is not somewhere you go when you die. The kingdom is a way, a rule that we live in right here and right now. Sin is not about the thing that keeps us from heaven. It's about the things that robs us from the dominion and the responsibility that we've been given as human beings, we've been called into. We've been talking about this a lot, that there's a way of life under the rule of law and there's a way of life under the rule of love. They're two fundamentally different systems. And we live in a world where it is driven by this rule of law. And it is. What I want you to hear is it's not wrong. I'm not bashing it. I'm just saying it is a way. And what it does is it exploits the worst parts of humans. We live in a world where facts are thrown around like confetti or they're launched like grenades, depending on your audience and your issue. And what I want to tell you is that facts aren't truth. I want to be really, really careful. Facts might be true, but they are not truth. When Jesus said, "I am the way, the truth, and the light," he wasn't saying, "I am this list of information, this list of facts that you can believe and trust and then be right on everything." He said, there is a way of life that allows us. He used this exact parallel when he says, you know, there's these two ways. Those who enter by the narrow gate, the gate is wide, it leads to destruction, but there is a narrow way. It's not a tightrope that you walk to not mess up your behavior. It's a way of life that you live under the rule of love, that we are not governed by anything else. What happens is in our culture, and then we're just prone to do this, and this is what's going to happen, is we line up facts and we ignore the story, and we do this at great risk. And I'm going to tell you very, very clearly, today when I'm done, you have a choice. You have a choice. You don't have to live in the way that I'm suggesting. I'm just saying what I believe is as a church, we have a way forward. We have a way together. So I have to correct myself every time I say that. We have a way that we've been invited to live that we get to participate in that will be drastically different than the way the world operates, particularly over the next few weeks and months. And what I'm telling you is I want to lead our church in that way. I want to learn it. I want to, you know, work as hard as I can to live in it. And I want to do this together. So I want you to understand, I need to ask you a favor. I don't want you to read into what I'm saying. I've already gotten this. I post something about Juneteenth and I get all kinds of responses thinking I'm making some political statement. I go to this thing and I get all kinds. I'm not making any political statements. Those are a way of life that is not the way I'm trying to walk in. I appreciate it. I understand it. It's necessary. I get it. I'm just saying where I'm at today is I'm going to learn to commit to live in a different way, and I'm inviting you to do the same. So we need to understand, I know we need rules, I know we need laws, I know we need systems, I know we need governance, I know we need all those things, but I'm also saying we need to understand the story. There is a story that everyone has, and we have to understand it. To ignore that is to miss, I think, one of the biggest opportunities that we have as a church, and perhaps if I make it a little bit more personal, the opportunity for me to actually become the kind of person that God has created me to become. I've been watching the news and listening to the narrative, and it's really amazing. It's not two stories. It's the same story from two different perspectives. And facts are thrown around, and I've seen this a million times. Every time someone says one thing, somebody gives them a bunch of facts to tell them why they're wrong. And someone says another thing, and then to give them a bunch of facts, tell them why they're wrong. Everybody's using facts to justify their positions, and neither of them are right. So I'm not interested in proving political points. I'm not interested in trying to prove anything. I'm not interested. I don't want you to read in between to find out if Mike's a Democrat or if he's a Republican. Please don't do that. What I'm telling you is I actually believe there is another way. It's taken me 48 years, or not that long, but because I haven't been thinking about that long, but it's taken me a really long time to begin to understand this, to start to understand this. I grew up in all the right things, right? I had all my politics right, I had all my theology right. I grew up like that, so I'm not indifferent to that perspective. And I've worked on both sides of this. But I wanna tell you what I think is important, because what's gonna happen is the rhetoric is going to heat up over the coming months, and there's gonna be more division and more hostility, but you and I have a choice. We have a choice. You can get sucked into it, or we can choose another way. One that I think will look very, very different, and I think might actually cause people that we know to take notice and go, wow, what is that about? So it's a posture of understanding. And I'll tell you what I've done, and some people have asked, and I've been trying to be mindful of this, is just how I've processed this. He taught this a few years ago, and one of the things that you hear when people say lean in, we lean in. To me, that's actually a physical posture. We lean in. We lean in to understand. To lean in is a posture of understanding. It's like what you have to do if you have two sides, two people on two sides, you have to create a pool of shared meaning. You have to create some space in which we can swim in the same water. If we're both sitting here lobbing grenades from one side to the other, it's just going to be a continued war. But if we learn how to say, hey, here's some things that we agree on, here's some things we share together, then the argument is, who's going first? Who's going to jump in first? Well, I'm just telling you, I'm going to wade into it. I'm willing to. And people say, Mike, we appreciate you speaking out. I'm not speaking out. I'm wading in. That's a big difference. I'm walking into this. I'm learning. My feet are wet. I might be up to my knees. I'm not sure how deep I am yet. But I began to read about Juneteenth. And I mentioned this if you watched, saw us on our Instagram post last week about Juneteenth. It was Friday. This is a significant day in our nation's history. One in which most white people don't know about, and one in which every black person that I talked to knew about. I spent a lot of time on the phone the last couple of weeks. I've talked to city leaders, I've talked to politicians, I've talked to police officers, I've talked to my black friends, I've talked to white friends, I've talked to people who were protesting, I've talked to people who were mad about people protesting, talked to people who were protesting, people who were mad at people protesting. I've talked to as many people as I can get on the phone with these last couple of weeks to listen and to learn and to understand. To try to see what's happening. And the conversations have been really all over the map. I've heard all the narratives that are out there. When someone's trying to tear down a statue, they say, we're trying to rewrite our history. And then I began to ask questions. I said, did you know about Juneteenth? This is one of my friends. And they said, no, I didn't know about Juneteenth. I said, it's the day that slavery was officially, and there's a whole history behind it if you do the research on it. I wasn't trying to prove a point. I'm trying to ask questions. I'm trying to be willing to ask questions. Is there something we're missing in this to understand? Instead of just writing a narrative that we always have heard. And I said, Juneteenth is the day that slavery was finally ended in the United States of America. And that's a really important day. Yeah, it is. I said, so maybe no one's trying to rewrite history. They're just trying to be included in it. That somehow our stories aren't different. And all these things that I've grown up thinking about, all of a sudden, they begin to sort of dissipate because I'm seeing things from a different perspective. I've never considered that before. And most people I've talked to, it wasn't that they're mad or they just never considered it before. They never leaned in to understand. They just hear something and it makes them, you know, spark something in them, and then they just react to it. Remember, we talked about this, that our gut reactions determine our readiness to understand. When Madison says to me, Dad, I can't believe you're making me a driving contract. I'm like, you're 15 and a half. You don't have any rights. It just means that I'm not ready to understand her perspective. That's all it means. So I got to go out and count to 10. I got to go out and be ready to listen to her rather than to try and convince her that I'm right in every point of the contract. Does that make sense? That's what we've got to get to. It's interesting, we live in these unprecedented times, I would say, and uncertainty is like jacked up. That's the way it's like, whoa, it's nothing is for sure. We don't know how things are gonna be. And psychologists and neurologists all tell us, I love brain science, all tell us that your brain, my brain, is hardwired to close loops, to create stories. It's why when someone cuts you off in traffic, you have a story about them. In fact, what's really interesting is now if you wear a mask or don't wear a mask, people have a story about you. Ooh, that person is, right? Because our brains are hardwired. We complete a story every time we see something. We just have to. And what they're telling us, I'm reading this book called Nonsense, and it's about our intolerance of uncertainty as human beings. And it says that you would think that in the face of uncertainty, we would be awakened that we actually don't know all the things we thought we know, right? That would be like an obvious thing. It's like, things are uncertain. I must not know what I'm supposed to know. That's not what human beings do. The greater the uncertainty, this is what it says, the greater the uncertainty, you would think that we get curious, but we don't. We actually double down on the positions that we've already long held. Think about this. When something pushes against you and what you have always known, you don't go, huh, I wonder what I'm missing. You go, oh, no way, man, you're wrong. And let me tell you all the reasons I'm right. That is our default position almost every single time. So what do we do? How do we think about this? It's almost as if Jesus knew this were the way human beings were, right? This is what I love about Jesus. If you study and spend time with Jesus and you try to learn what it means to walk in his way, if you are looking for answers and facts, Jesus will frustrate you to no end. That's why I love the Old Testament so much, because it proves a lot of my points. Jesus, on the other hand, he doesn't. He messes with them. Do you know why? Because he didn't come to give me ammunition to prove that I'm right. He came to invite me to live in a way that I was intended to live. He came to give me life. He came to forgive me of sin. He came to make me right with the Father. He came to empower me to be about his work of redemption here in this world. And what you find in a lot of his stories, his parables, is you find a lot of language of hiddenness, things being hidden or kept secret. And it's really intriguing, especially in this thing, and I want to talk about that for a few moments, and then we'll be done, give you some homework, and we'll be done. But Matthew 13 is the famous parable of the soils. Jesus would get people together, he would tell them a story. He would get people together, he'd say, hey, what's in your pocket? Oh, there's a coin, let me tell you a story about this coin. Oh, we're going fishing, let me tell you a story about some fish. He would always like involving people in story. I think it's because he understood that including people in story, right, was a much better way to awaken or to help us understand or see things we had not seen before. So Jesus gets all these people together and he says, there's a story, there's a guy, he's got some seed and he scatters some seed and some of it falls on the path and on the road and some of it falls on the rocky soil and some of it falls in the thorns and some of it falls on good soil. He tells a little story about it and that's it. That's all he says. No application, not like you should be morally better about this or you should do that. None of that, just the story. So his disciples get him together kind of on the side, and this is found in Matthew 13. And here's how it unfolds. Matthew chapter 13, verse 10. Then the disciples came to him and they said, why do you speak this in parables? This is what I want to ask Jesus. Why don't you just tell me what I'm supposed to do? Tell me how I'm supposed to vote. Why do you speak to them in parables? And he answered them, to you it has been given to know the secrets of the kingdom of heaven, but to them it has not been given. And he all of a sudden begins to create these two ways, these two groups. Those who know the secrets of the kingdom and those who haven't been given that. For to the one who has, more will be given and he will have an abundance. But from the one who does not have, even what he has will be taken away. That sounds kind of mean. So then Jesus just clears this right up. This is why I speak to them in parables. And we all lean forward, we lean in with our pens and our paper. Jesus is about to tell us why he speaks in parables. Because seeing they do not see, and hearing they do not hear, nor do they understand. And he cleared it right up. In case you're wondering, this is what Isaiah the prophet actually said in verse 14. You will hear, indeed hear, and you will never understand. You will indeed see, but you will never perceive. For this people's heart has grown dull, and with their eyes they can barely see, and with their with their ears they can barely hear, and their eyes they have closed, lest they should see with their eyes and hear with their ears and understand with their heart and turn, and I would heal them. What is this secretness, this hiddenness? I was having conversations this past week and people telling me about the Bible. Mike, the Bible and all of its truth and all of its principles. We're talking about this. I said, this idea of understanding the words on this page are the most important thing we can do. Now, please understand, I study the Bible, I read the Bible, I trust the Bible, I trust it, I look to it. All those things are true about me. But when I began to think about this, the context, what it is Jesus invited us into a relationship with him, a way of life to learn. And this happens when we trust him. When we trust him, what he's talking about, this idea of sight is not what we can see and articulate and understand and put into our systematic approaches. It's what we experience as we walk with him. It's what our hearts are awakened to. Faith is defined for us as a perception. We walk by faith and not by sight. It's a perception. It's a way of seeing the world. This is what he's talking about. Eugene Peterson translates this in The Message, same passage. And he says, they said, tell us, you know, why are you telling stories? And he says, you've been given insights into God's kingdom. Not everybody has this insight. It has not been given to them. When someone has a ready heart, When someone has a ready heart, the insights and the understandings flow freely. It's a posture before God first. But if there is no readiness, any trace of receptivity soon disappears. I tell stories to create readiness, to nudge people towards receptive insight. He tells us these things to cause us to lean and say, God, what is it you're saying? What is it you're doing? He goes on, he explains the parable, the soils. He says, some of it fell on the road and the birds came and ate it up. Some of it fell in the rocky soil and didn't have any root. And so when everything's got hot and hard, just disappeared. Some of it fell in the thorny soil and it got tangled up with the, and he talks about the cares and the distractions, the riches of this world. We don't care about the things of the kingdom because we can entertain ourselves with our own means and ways. Then he says, oh, there's a third or a fourth soil. You see, what I want us to do is I want us to lean in, because I think it's the first step in learning to care. Leaning in to understand is the first step in learning to care. Don't, and I'll just say it like this, you don't have to pretend that you care about things that you don't care about. This is not about trying to feign some care about the issue of racial injustice or anything else. What it is about is learning to lean into those things in order to understand them, because in learning to understand, you will actually learn to care, because you enter into a narrative. You begin to see things in ways you haven't seen them before. Without understanding, we won't care about anything different than we already care about. And our culture lives in this system where everything is defined by agree or disagree. And my question is, what if that's insufficient? What if just agreeing or disagree were an insufficient foundation upon which this way of life, this calling that God has on us, can't support? So Matthew 13:23, he ends with this. After he talks about the other soils, he says, as for what was sown on the good soil, this is the one who hears the word and understands. I don't think the four soils are like, you're this, you're this, you're this, and you're this. It's a test for us. Does heat and difficulty cause me to abandon my faith? Does comfort and the capacity to control my own circumstances cause me to abandon my faith or to trust in myself? Or maybe I need to dig up some stuff and cultivate some soil for which some of this can be implanted into my heart and begin to grow, lest they see with their eyes and hear with their ears and understand with their hearts, lest God do something in us that awakens us to this way of life that he's invited us into. What can you do to cultivate that kind of soil? What it says is, that soil bears fruit, 30, 60, even 100-fold. What about the space that you've been given influence over? What can you do there? One of the things that I've been doing is just asking questions. Awkward questions for sure, but asking questions. You know, Gerald Fadiami, we were talking a couple weeks ago, and he said one of the greatest ministry lessons he learned was, I'd rather offend someone with my presence than offend them with my absence. If I'm curious as to whether I should go, I'd rather offend them with my presence and then be bothered that I came to see them than bothered that I didn't. And I kind of took the same approach with my own thing. I would rather offend someone by trying to care than by appearing indifferent. And I've had some very awkward exchanges over the last few weeks, to be sure. But I've just decided for me, I'm testing my heart. God, help me care. Help me learn. Give me your heart in this. I'm going to lean in. I'm going to ask the kind of questions. People say, Mike, are we just going to become, you know, a race church? Are we just going to become this? No, this is not any different. We've said this from years and years and years. We don't stand on issues. We walk with people. The reason I care is I know people. I know people who I love and I care about. And if something matters to them, it is an act of love for me to figure out how to make it matter to me and to us. That's the way of Jesus. That's what he's inviting us into. So here's what I want you to do. And Clay mentioned this last week when he was talking. He said, you just got to make it personal. I can't change the whole world, but I can change this. You remember Jesus' prayer? Thy kingdom come on earth as it is in heaven. Thy will be done on earth as it is in heaven. It means there's two different ways. I can't change everything. I can change what happens here. I can say, God, your will be done right here in my mind and my heart. Your will be done what my eyes see and what my mouth says. Your will be done right here. And then I can get a few other people and we go, hey, are we committed to making sure that God's will is done in your little sphere, in my little sphere, and then in our little sphere? And eventually what happens is this little sphere, we just say, you know what, we can't change everything. But then as far as this rule and this reign, this is what we're going to do. You know what Jesus promised? That a little leaven actually affects the whole lump. You don't have to prove anything. You just have to walk in the way that you've been created to live. So what are the things that you don't have to care about? Just make a list. You don't have to be mean or aggro about it. Just write it down. What are the things you don't have to care about? I don't have to care about world hunger. I don't have to care about, I mean, there's a lot of things on that you can put on that list. We can't do everything, but you can do something, right? That's what Clay said. You can just make it personal, make it right in front of you. And the second question is, what would it require of you to care? What would it take? Is it a conversation? Is it just some own internal heart check? Is it education? What I've learned about people is our default position in disagreement is contempt. We ask questions like this. How can they think like that? How can they go to that rally? How can they go to that protest? How can they vote for that person? How can they believe like this? How can you say that? Those aren't questions. Those are declarations of contempt. What I would encourage you to do is to change your declarations of contempt into a posture of curiosity. And instead you say, how can you think like that? Can you help me understand? Do you see the difference? This is not what you're going to hear. What I want for you to commit to this week is not to care yet. If you don't learn to understand, you're really likely to only care about the things you already care about. I want you to commit to cultivate understanding. To cultivate understanding first, because it is the first step in learning to care. I don't think that unity, what God is calling us to, is the absence of disagreement. You know what it is? I'm gonna tell you next week. You knew it's coming. What I want for us to do is to just embrace what Jesus asks us to pray. Your will be done right here in my little sphere. Right here. Just like it is, where your rule is perfectly executed. You do that, I do that, we do that. And I guarantee you, things will be different. We've got to cultivate the good soil of understanding. As we conclude our time, we're going to kind of declare this song. And I think the first line is just an invitation to come together, to just step into this place together, trusting and asking and seeking and knocking. I believe that God is waiting, calling his people into this place. Father, thank you so much for what you are doing. God, help us to lean in, to understand. God, in that we would begin to get your heart. There are people and there are stories whom you've put in our path, whom you've called us in a relationship with. And God, there's pain and there's anger and there's fear. And you've promised us that love drives out fear. It just doesn't allow it place to grow. God, you've called us into that. So I ask, Father, that we would be that good soil. We would cultivate a heart of understanding that your life might produce fruit in ours that becomes beauty and becomes nourishment for the world around us. God, it's desperately needed. Let us be a light in the world. And I lift all this in the name of your son, Jesus. Amen.